Open the meeting of the House Committee on Business and Labor for February 25th, 2013. I'm also going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2448, and this was the holdover from Friday, and I appreciate people coming back on Monday to testify on this one. Jan, if you could kind of
Madam
go
Chair?
Through. Yes.
Do I smell bad or something? Because it seems like
I no. There's no baby residue on you this morning.
I can't believe you've asked that.
Madam Chair, I think things, you know, you make your own choices. I would suggest to you that you might think that you're so special you have a very special location.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
No, it is nothing personal, Representative Fagan. Representative Fagan.
Yeah, Fagan.
So anyway, Jan, if you could summarize
Madam Chair, members, this is the bill that requires any issue that's subject to collective bargaining during the term of the agreement that's not resolved through negotiation to be resolved through binding arbitration. There are no amendments before you, and that is it.
Okay. Joe Basler, please. Actually, does Mike Tedesco want to be up there also? Got the two floors.
There we go.
Hey, thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. We represent about 20, I just said this last week, so I'll say it again. We represent about 24,000 public employees and private nonprofit workers across the state of Oregon. This bill was put in at our request. It's looking to fix the sort of inequality we found under PECPA. Right now, after the contract is put into place between a public employer and its employees, the employer can institute a change to a subject. And Mr. Tedesco will probably help me if I screw up this too much. Something that is not covered directly under the contract, the employer can make a change to the policy that is happening in the institution, and you have 90 days to bargain that issue. Right now, after 90 days, they just implement. The employer just starts doing whatever the change they want to have happen. There doesn't feel like there's any real mechanism to push for compromise. The employer can just sort of wait it out, and we get what we get. And it sort of flies in the face of sort of fair bargaining, in our opinion. So, for instance, I have some testimony from members and from one of our other staff people that sort of highlights this problem. So, hypothetically, if furlough days aren't included in your contract, but you want to implement furlough days, you know you can't get that through the regular bargaining process. You wait a month until after the contract's done, and then you say, all right, we're going to do, 26 furlough days. And you have 90 days, and then we're going to implement. Oh, and by the way, we'll meet and talk about it, but we're going to do it anyway. And sort of puts our folks in a really tough spot. Their only other option is to sort of try to gear up and strike within that 90-day period. We don't think that is a helpful or meaningful solution. So we're looking to, originally the bill I requested was at the end of that, move the period to 60 days and then move to a binding arbitration solution. Some of my friends requested a change to that, and I think we're putting in some amendments to, instead of binding arbitration, go to mediation and then binding arbitration to sort of create an interim step to make it a little bit more palatable and easier to negotiate. So we're looking for solutions, but we feel like right now we don't have any, and this is a really system that's easy to abuse. So thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, when Senate Bill 750 was passed, this expedited bargaining was put into place back in 1995, and the idea was that matters come up during the period after the contract has been settled that were usually minor in nature, and there needed to be a way to give flexibility to get things changed if it were needed to. And this was part of management's pitch at the time of, quote, leveling the playing field. In effect, this has been the most single injurious section of Senate Bill 750. This has had the biggest impact. Now, I was here the other day and heard the school employee representative, Ms. Freely, testify that this is used for minor matters and it's infrequently used for small things. That couldn't be more incorrect. I can cite to you a number of situations that's involved OSCA, school employees, the classified workers. We have lost bus drivers in Wilhelmina and in Central Point. We have lost retiree health insurance for workers in Clatskanie. We have
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Michael Tedesco. I'm a lawyer, and I represent the Oregon School Employees Association along with other labor organizations. I also teach labor law and arbitration law at the University of Oregon Law School and have done so for over 10 years.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry.
Please go on.
I just feel passionate about this. And the reason I feel passionate about it is because, like I say, we've lost workers to contracting out when we had no meaningful ability to bargain. We've had workers lose retiree health care benefits in Clatskanie. We've had furloughs imposed on us in Park Rose. And just recently in Medford, we had the PERS pickup taken away through expedited bargaining. How does this happen? It happens because there is no dispute resolution mechanism embodied in expedited bargaining. They indicate they're going to change policy or something that the contract doesn't cover. And the next thing you know, you're in 90-day bargaining. And then we do this dance, get to the end of 90-day bargaining, and there's a unilateral implementation. Our only recourse is to strike. Now, you might say, well, that's a significant recourse. It isn't when you think about who the membership of OSCA is. The average income for an OSCA classified worker in Oregon schools is less than $21,000. These are poverty level folks, disproportionately female, and many of whom are single moms raising kids. The chances of those people going on strike is next to non-existent. As a matter of fact, there has not been a classified school employee strike in Oregon since I started practicing labor law for unions in the state in 1980. It's not going to happen. And the employers know that. And to write it off saying that this is minor things is disingenuous to the point of laughable. Let me tell you what happened in Clatskanie, because I was involved in the bargaining. We finished bargaining a contract in October of the year, so the contract would have been retroactive to July. 2 weeks later, the school superintendent tells OSCA, oh, you know that retiree health insurance program that's in the district policies and it's been there for years and years and years, we don't want to do that anymore. So we made a demand to bargain. As soon as you make the demand to bargain, the time starts. They had three sessions. We tried to sunset the existing employees so they'd continue to be covered by the plan. They said no. We then cut the plan in half. We're bargaining against ourselves at this point. And he said no. And the school superintendent said to our business agent, what do you want me to do? My hands are tied. There was no bargaining. And as a result, as soon as we got past the 90 days, something was implemented. Now, what is this law going to do if this change takes place? It puts in a dispute resolution process. I couldn't support more the concept of using mediation here. And frankly, I don't care if it's a state mediator or a private mediator. It doesn't matter. Mediation's a good thing, just as a general rule. It puts a stop on the process. It calls the public employer to the table to have to justify their position, at least to somebody. And then it goes a step further and provides the idea of interest arbitration. And what does interest arbitration do? It means that no one's going to get bullied into losing benefits. What it means is if the public employer has an adequate justification for doing what they're doing, then the then they have nothing to fear from an arbitrator. It's a matter of logic as opposed to brute force and power, which is what's being used on school employees now. So I couldn't speak more in favor of this bill. Something really needs to be done here. I have personally seen people lose their jobs, lose their families, and this is not hyperbole, which was mentioned last week on Friday. I've seen it. I mean, I've seen school bus drivers get driven out of town because the contractor wouldn't hire them because they were union representatives for the school bus drivers in Central Point. This lady had to leave her family and leave Central Point and go live in Roseburg in a trailer working a part-time job because her job got contracted out and the private sector company would not hire her back. Lawsuits ensued and she got paid, frankly, a pittance because some multinational company came in and took over those buses. And that happened as a direct result of expedited bargaining, which is a misnomer because there is no bargaining. If you all could, I wish you all could come to the table with me and see what it looks like. It's collective begging, not collective bargaining. With that, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of the panel? Mr. Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, when labor management engage in collective bargaining, is there a presumption that some end is achieved in those negotiations?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the process of collective bargaining is so important because it's a way in which ideas get traded. It's not even so much what winds up in a contract, but rather it's a communication piece between the employees and the employer and also the community, because we've taken steps over the years to open up bargaining so that the community has some involvement to the extent they wish it. What happens in expedited bargaining isn't that. When we go into expedited bargaining with an employer, their mind's made up, the decision's made. And in the circumstances where I've dealt with that, it's just, like I say, it's a steamroller. In regular bargaining, there's so many different issues on the table. There are trade-offs being made. There's larger conversations being had. That doesn't happen in expedited bargaining.
Okay, thank you. More other questions?
I was going to request a follow-up.
Please.
Thank you very much. With respect to the expedited bargaining, the conversation that you were talking about, I'm curious how the end result differs in the two instances.
The end result between regular bargaining
yes.
and expedited bargaining. In regular bargaining, for one thing, there's an extended period. There's 150 days before either party could request mediation. Once mediation is requested, then at least you're going to go through one, maybe two sessions of mediation as a general rule. At the conclusion, and by the way, mediation is uncommonly successful in Oregon. Most recent statistics I saw is that mediation is successful about 85 to 88% of the time. Now, don't quote me on those numbers, but they may be from a couple of years back. I've been at this a while. At the conclusion of mediation, then there's a cooling off period of an additional 30 days, and then the employer can unilaterally implement. Now, this is in strikeable units. What happens over that period of time is that the parties are able to educate the public as to their position. As a practical matter, in 90-day bargaining, that can't happen, and I'll give you the example of Central Point. We were notified in April, in late March, that they were looking at contracting out school bus services. We bargained in April and May to no effect. They announced at the end of June, or at the end of June or early July, that they had accepted the bid of the contractor and were going to contract out in September. Now, these are schools. There are no school employees working from pretty much early June through September. Who are we going to strike? You can't go on strike. There's no, it's effectively null and void. You have no one to go on strike with because there's no school during that period. So the difference between regular bargaining and expedited bargaining, frankly, couldn't be more immense because the time constraints are shortened, and frankly, the school boards have been advised, if you want to make a change, implement it in the spring, and that basically neuters the union's ability to do much. Even public campaigning in the summer doesn't work out very well because a lot of the school employees are working their other jobs elsewhere. So the system really is broke.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say, appreciate your testimony today. And I know it was a long weekend after hearing what we heard Friday. So I appreciate you bringing it forward. And thanks for also talking about the timeline of that situation with the inability for somebody to actually go on strike and make a compelling argument in any way during the summer when they're school employees. So thanks again for being here. And thanks for all your work. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I do have a question. Your experience with demand interim bargaining and the demands to bargain during the interim contract, are these all issues that could have been dealt with in the regular bargaining process?
Absolutely. Take, for example, the situation in Klatskanai that I described where they were going to eliminate retiree health. We had the contract, the ink on the contract was barely dry when they told us they wanted to do that. They could have done one of two things. If they identified that as a cost problem, they could have raised the issue in regular bargaining, in which case we could have made trade-offs, it could have been solved in a larger context of other issues, or they could have waited out the 2 or 3 year contract. The number of people that were going to retire out of the Klatskanai School District just wasn't that significant. But it was easier to do this way. And that's the part that really is the problem. This is being abused. You know, we have a saying in our business, you know, you don't try to fix what ain't broke, if you excuse the misgrammar. In fact, this is broke, and we're looking at you for a fix.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next three, Nancy Hungerford, Mike Eliason, and Diana Moffitt, and then we'll end with Justin Black after this panel. Make sure that you identify yourself for the record, even though
Thank
we
you.
Know you.
Madam Chair, I've got enough voice, I think, for 3 minutes. I'm Nancy Hungerford, represent school districts and community colleges. I've bargained over 400 contracts in this state in the last 32 years. I also taught collective bargaining for Lewis and Clark and Portland State since 1982. I'm here on my own volition. None of my clients asked me to be here, but I also have very strong feelings about this bill because it would eliminate a provision of expedited bargaining that has corrected a problem that we had prior to 1995. And that problem largely was the prolonging bargaining over single issues that could have been dealt with. There's no reason in a single issue why you can't resolve those in a 90-day period. Let me speak, and I'm always happy to follow my good friend Michael Tedesco because then I get to counter his comments. First of all, the kinds of things that go to expedited bargaining are ones the union could have demanded to bargain before. So take the Klatskanai example. many teacher unions and some classified unions bargained into their collective bargaining agreement an early retirement provision. Had they done that in Clatskanie, the employer would have had to wait until that contract expired. They didn't do that. They could have. They also have the ability to bargain into contracts, provisions relating to contracting out. They can bargain or attempt to bargain a provision that blocks contracting out entirely, and such provisions do exist. I think the Beaverton School District is an example where OSEA bargained that provision into their collective bargaining agreement. Furlough days. What union today doesn't anticipate the possibility that there will be furlough days? They ought to be. They can bargain those when their contract comes open, along with all the other issues, including pay. And that's the time when the employer has the opportunity to deal with insurance costs and pay and so forth. But in many of these cases, the union has tried to bargain furlough days but been unsuccessful. The union has not been able to undo the ability of management to impose furlough days. So expedited bargaining then is another shot at it, if you will, but they had the opportunity to bargain that when the contract was open. Few of these are situations where there's a surprise to either management or to unions. So I guess I reject the idea that the union is toothless in this case. The second objection I have is that I think it's ironic that I, as a representative of management or experienced with management bargaining, would be here defending collective bargaining. But at a time when, across the nation, there are a lot of efforts to undo the collective bargaining rights of various public employee groups, I believe that collective bargaining here works and should be allowed to work. The solution in the bill is to turn that over to a binding interest arbitrator. Who are these folks? They're on a state panel. They are supposed neutrals, but none of them have any background in K through 12 education. There's about 50 some people on the panel, and the last time I looked, there was no recent educational background, K through 12, for any person on that panel. They must also split the baby most of the time, or at least rule enough in each direction, because they are only employed if they remain acceptable to management and labor. So the incentive there is to decide enough cases on one side or the other so that they won't be crossed off the list, because we get a list and from that we select by crossing off those people most objectionable to us. So the system itself does not lend itself to what I would call unbiased decisions. There are so many other factors that come into play, but primarily object to the fact that there's limited background on the part of people who will be making important policy decisions. And I have given you pages of examples, but I would just also point out that where these are those issues that come up unbeknownst to management sometimes, and a recent example that I've dealt was in the Tigard School District, where the union demanded to bargain over whether or not their registered nurses who were employees of the school district and members of the bargaining unit could be required to provide service to medically fragile kids. Now, that would seem to be a no-brainer. There are RNs with 30 years experience in some cases. As a matter of fact, the school district had hired contract nurses so that they wouldn't be requiring their regular nurses to do this, because these are kids who cannot attend school without an RN physically present at all times. But on a single day when the contract nurse was sick, the replacement contract nurse got in a traffic accident on the way to the school. The school district called in one of their regular nurses, and the nurse went to the association and said, "I shouldn't be required to do this." Their solution was that this child stay home from school that day because the school couldn't staff, although they had RNs on. But when the district ordered the nurse to go and provide that kind of life-saving background assistance to the other staff, the union demanded to bargain. Now, we didn't think that that was an issue we had to bargain because it seemed like a matter of assignment. But the employer is in the position of saying, if we don't agree to bargain, we will have an unfair labor practice against us. 2-3 years down the road, we might get a resolution to that. So we agreed to bargain for the 90-day period. During that 90 days, we offered all sorts of training provisions that they couldn't be put into certain classrooms without the requisite training, but there was no agreement. And finally, the employer was obliged to unilaterally implement. I don't care to have binding interest arbitrators make decisions about who's going to serve medically fragile kids and whether the district can make that assignment of duties to an RN that they choose to employ. If you take a look at all of the examples that I've provided you, these are the kinds of cases that have come before the Employment Relations Board because there's been a dispute about it, but under this bill there would be no longer the expedited provision as a way of resolving these. Finally, I would say I support the idea of mediation as long as it doesn't delay the 90-day timeline and as long as you eliminate binding interest arbitration. And I have written contract language in some districts where we agree that if there is a situation where the union demands to bargain and they have a right to bargain over a change the employer is going to make, that we agree up front we're going to put in a request for mediation from day one that will occur between the 60th and 90th day. That way we get in the lineup for mediators. We have a mediation session. You can write that provision into the law, although I would also caution you that these are going to be the same mediators you're going to be requiring to handle those general successor bargaining disputes, and there are three of them, so there's a short supply sometimes. But you can put mediation in here. I would endorse that, but it has to be done so that the timeline is not extended, and basically binding interest arbitration is not the solution to this. What is the solution is collective bargaining, and I also would say that the employees in the state, particularly bus drivers, as Mr. Tedesco has pointed out, that in the last legislative session, this legislative assembly passed and the governor signed a bill that says that contracting out can only occur if there are no personnel costs, if there are no savings other than personnel cost savings. That is law. And so any district that is going to contract out work has to be able to show that they can obtain savings that are other than those by replacing public employees with contracted employees. You have addressed that issue, I think, satisfactorily. There have been a minimal number of instances since that time of contracting out. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Mike Eliason, General Counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. In the interest of time, and because I'm sandwiched between two experienced labor negotiators, I'll be exceedingly brief and cede my time to Ms. Moffitt. But needless to say, I've passed out written testimony. Association of Oregon Counties is opposed to this bill for some of the reasons I've outlined in our brief one-pager. I will just say that, you know, currently we're in an extremely difficult budget climate, especially for historically timber-dependent counties. At times, midterm bargaining is used fairly sparingly, but at times counties are forced into, county boards of commissioners are forced into choices that no board of commissioners wants to face, which is occasionally deciding between layoffs and potentially furlough days. When something such as furlough days, for example, are implemented, it's done across the board. The board themselves are not implementing something they're not willing to take themselves, in hypothetically a 10% pay cut, for example, while trying to maintain the services that they're trying to provide to their community and still provide full benefits to their employees. So I will just say, I'll cut my comments off there and just say that AOC is opposed to this bill, and I'll turn it over to
Thank you very much.
Ms. Moffitt.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, well, if I could just ask a quick question.
Quick question, please.
Ms. Hungerford suggested that an amendment about mediation into the timeline. Would you be supportive of that?
Chair Doherty, Representative Kennemer, I believe mediation is already an option under the statute.
Not
mandatory, yeah. In the midterm bargaining process. It's something that we'd certainly talk about. I could take that back to our membership and we could talk about it. certainly something that we're open to, because typically I think mediation is involved in these types of situations. But I don't, and I believe it's optional but not mandatory under the statute, so we'd certainly be willing to talk about that.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Moffitt.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Diana Moffitt. I'm the executive director for the Local Government Personnel Institute, and more importantly, I serve as one of their labor relations lawyers. So I represent public employers throughout the state of Oregon. And just to address this last comment that just came up about mediation, I can tell you that I've been involved in many midterm bargaining situations, and I've never had an employer turn down a request for mediation, and oftentimes we're even suggesting it. It's a very economical way to settle these matters. The ERB, bless their hearts, only charge $500 to send their mediator over there. They're almost back up to full staff, and they're able to get us in on fairly short notice. So I do want to make that point. The other thing that I wanted to mention was that currently any public employee union is allowed to bring up any mandatory subject of bargaining during the collective bargaining process. So it's not that they just have to react to us as the employer. Let's say the employer puts on sick leave time and wages. The union doesn't just react to those. They can say, wait, we want to talk about retiree insurance also, and we want to talk about contracting out. They can force us to bargain over those during the regular bargaining process. The midterm bargaining process was put into place to deal with those change in circumstances that come up. Like, for instance, when Columbia County had to potentially deal with different types of cost-saving measures on furloughs, what they did is they routinely bargained midterm with AFSCME every year during the life of the agreement to try and limit the number of furlough days that they had to institute, as opposed to locking everyone in to the ones that they had to. Secondly, I would like to say that if this bill was to pass, one of the results would be that these unions would have no incentive to come to a full agreement with the public employer during contract negotiation bargaining. They would rather wait and bring up individual piecemeal issues outside of the contract to force litigation. And let's talk about litigation. What is litigation? I'm a litigator by nature. I was a prosecutor here in Marion County for 14 years under Dale Penn. And now I do a lot of litigation, too, in the public sector arena, and it's expensive. An interest arbitration, even on a midterm single issue, I did one for Beaverton just a couple of years ago, and I think the price tag was like $20,000. We brought in, in that case we had a local arbitrator, but the list of arbitrators, a lot of them are from out of state. They don't know Oregon. They don't know Oregon's economy. They don't know how to say Willamette. They, you know, all kinds of things, and it's really sort of, if you will, I don't think I can say that, but a game where you toss dice out. you know, the other thing, what does interest arbitration do? Litigation, it causes workplace angst. And if you look at the public policy behind PECPA, the policy behind PECPA is to have workplace stability and harmony. Interest arbitration does not promote that. There is a balance here. The balance is that the union has a right to strike. I can't speak about schools because I don't work in that arena, but it just, from this person's perspective, it seems to me, if I'm looking at a house and the problem with the house is that the front door is the wrong color, this bill wants to repaint the entire house. If you've got a problem with the door, fix the door. Don't repaint the entire house. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the panelists? Mr. Matthews?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where to start? What I'll do is I'll make comments, and if you want to respond, I think that's easiest. You provided several examples, Ms. Hungerford, and I appreciate your testimony. I really do. Thanks for coming forward. But you said that there's several examples of the union's demand to bargain. I just want to make sure that we understand that that's a reaction to an action is what that is. That's not their desire to come forward and say, let's talk about this issue. That's their saying, before you implement this change, we have to talk about this. So that's already occurring. The fact that unions could have bargained something and bring forward, I've negotiated contracts, certainly not as many as you, but why is it in the union's best interest to bring negative impacts forward? It just amazes me that you would say that it's their responsibility to bring these proposals forward when they're negatively impacted in that manner. That just seems odd to me. Last thing, you mentioned the panel's supposedly neutral. Since 2008, I'm told, the management has won 10 out of 13 herb rulings. That's a pretty good record. I don't know why we'd be afraid of that. And then mediation seems to be very rare, yet you're making it sound like it's an everyday occurrence. Last thing I want to say is, in your comment, you just said that the workplace angst is what you referred to it as. I can think of no more harmonious activity than for somebody to pretend that they have the intent to bargain in good faith, to bring something forward, to waste, you know, 60 days of my time, and then just unilaterally make the change anyway. That would not exactly be workplace angst resolving it by any stretch. So I have some concerns about some of what we're hearing. I get that there's two sides of the argument, but I think that this is being painted in a way that I can't support on your end.
With all due respect, I'll tell you that of the employers that I've represented over the years, which are hundreds of them, I have never had an employer say to me, behind closed doors, with attorney-client privilege, Ms. Moffitt, we really want to screw it to the unions on this one. Let's lay back in the weeds, not bargain this, and then we're going to just shove this down their throats. Those are not the employers that I represent, and they're not the employers that you have in the state of Oregon, sir.
Madam Chair, if I could. Mm-hmm.
And then
so let's go to the specific incidents with the bus drivers. Are you suggesting that could have been avoided had the union just bargained that in their bargaining? I mean, those aren't your clients, apparently, based on what you just said.
As I said earlier, I don't deal with bus drivers or those situations.
But we also mentioned they're not in Oregon, and I think that in that case it seems like
okay. If we can move on.
Sorry,
any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Black. Keep your remarks brief, please.
Redwood had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is that what you got out of that?
I'll get it.
Could you bring the panel?
That's fine, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association. Being the last one, I will be very, very brief. The Oregon Education Association is supportive of House Bill 2448 and the amendment to include mediation and added on to the timeline, as well as allowing either party to call for interest arbitration. And where we come from this is, you know, I think the employers talked a lot about things coming up. We fully understand that there are budget constraints, things happen, employers need to come forward with some items. I will say that in the vast majority of items that we see come forward, it feels like there is an inevitability about the about what they're proposing. We are coming to the table with less time to prepare than the employer. We are coming to the table with an understanding that if we cannot come up with a better solution, they are going to implement their solution no matter what we think. And the real example that I bring forward on this is the case of Three Rivers School District in Josephine County. They decided they wanted to make a change in the class schedule for high schools, which included a workload increase for our high school members. They made the decision at the school board level. They created a design team, came up with everything they wanted to do, and then our members had to say, hey, wait a minute, we'd like to be involved in this conversation. There are parents that disagree with the solution that you're proposing. There are even school board members that disagree with the solution. Our members came forward and said, you need to bargain over this. The district said, we don't think we need to, but we'll sit down with you for a little while. After they've already made the decision. The 90 days expired, they implemented what they had already decided 90 days beforehand, and it took 3 years later for us to file ULP, or we filed the ULP, and it took 3 years later for the decision to be repealed and for the district to be told, no, you cannot make these decisions on your own. You need to involve the members of the district. And that's where we feel like most of these head. These are decisions that have been already made before we even enter the room, and we don't feel like in the 90 days we're given the ability to really come up with better solutions or to have our voice heard. So I'll leave it at that. We are supportive of both the bill, but also the amendment to include mediation to allow either party to call for interest arbitration. We feel like this will make the process better.
Yeah, fine. And Representative, we can bring up the last panel for your question.
No, that's fine. I can ask questions here.
Okay, are there any questions? Mr. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate your comments. In the panel that preceded you, we had two people testify that, in essence, a bargaining that occurs in expedited bargaining could have taken place during the regular bargaining rounds. Could you please tell me what the trigger is for requesting expedited negotiations?
Not being a labor lawyer, I do not know the specifics, so I don't feel like I should answer that question.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Mr. Black.
Yes. We do have, those are all the people that we have signed up. We do have, for the record, Evan Wickersham, Aaron O'Connell, and Pam Benham of AFSCME presented written testimony, as did Jerry Willey from Hill City of Hillsborough, and Cindy Robert on behalf of the City of Medford, and also the City of Tigard and Association of Oregon Industries. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2448 and open up the public hearing on House Bill 2688. Jan, if you could review that.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill changes from $250 to $1,000 the value of chattels sold at foreclosure sale, for which the person must file a statement of account with the county. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you very much. You could identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Rep, District 20, and with me I have a constituent who has brought this bill to me. Mr. Bridges owns a mini storage, a storage, not particularly mini, but a storage operation. And he explained to me that every time somebody leaves a bunch of stuff in his storage, he loses a whole bunch of money because first he has to go through a process of trying to get his money from the person who has left stuff in his storage and is not paying. Then he gets to open it up, and then he has to have it appraised. And if it is appraised over $250, he then has to make newspaper notice and pay for him to get that $250 worth of stuff notified that it is hanging out there. And eventually, he can dispose of it and be done with it. But in the meantime, he's over $1,000 into the process, and the value of the stuff is really minimal. So what this basically suggests is that before he has to go through all of that notification and process, that the value be higher, and it is suggested $1,000 in this bill. Now, Mr. Bridges is with me. He can explain this in greater detail because he lives it. I would ask the committee to be mindful he has a little hearing difficulty, so please speak loudly, and Mr. Bridges can speak for himself.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. I'm representing Bridges RV Storage. We are an RV storage. Oh, excuse me. Bernard Bridges. I go by Bud. I'm sorry. And it's we're an RV storage business. We've been in business since 1972. And myself and my wife are the sole corporations. Anything has to be done, we're the two that do it. This statute, when it was first instituted at $250, was probably equivalent to $1,000 back in those days. I just happen to have a sale that is going through, will be taking place here March 22nd, and give you as an example on it. The rents, first off, the first thing you've got to do is we go for two and a half months before we file a default notice. And a default notice has to be sent out by certified mail. So you have the expense and the joy of going down to the local post office and standing in line for half an hour where you can mail your letter and pay the $6.50 to mail that. Okay. By the time you have your sale, let's go to the next. You wait for a minimum of 60 days, and then you send out the foreclosure sale. Now, that foreclosure sale has to be more than 30 days past there. So what I'm trying to, I do it, everyone does it on a monthly basis. You can add up the months that you've lost rent on this place that you could have collected from somebody else. And here again, when you send out the foreclosure, you have to send it by certified mail, so you get to go back down to the post office and stand in line again. All right, you've got your foreclosure sent out. So you send out an ad into the newspaper. You've got to publish it for 2 weeks prior to the sale in the public records of the local newspaper. In our particular case, that costs about $250 a week for a one-inch ad in the paid notices section. So you've got $250 there. Then you come time for your sale. And sale is going to cost you anywhere from $50 to $100 just to conduct the sale. And in the meantime, you might also, or like in, for instance, my case, I haven't done any sales for some time, and so I checked with my attorney to make sure that I was getting everything correct. All in all, I've got over $995 in this particular sale. And whether it brings that amount, I don't know. I've had a gentleman look at it, and he told me, he says, well, you know, I haven't been to a sale for years that have brought in over $1,000 on the sale. So he says, your chance of recovery right now is very slim for being able to recover all your costs. The only thing I'm asking for, and I looked at it, is the $250 versus $1,000. $1,000 is more realistic for today's market. 10 years from now, I hope I'm back here. I hope I'm old, lived that long enough to come back here and say, hey, we need to go to $1,500 or $2,000 for actual costs because of the cost of, you know, how much the money is going to be worth at that time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of Mr. Bridges?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bridges.
Thank you for your testimony today. Thanks for being here and working with your good representative to bring this forward. My question, you know, my only exposure has been, I'm a firefighter. We had a fire at one of these public storage lockers. It wiped out a whole bank of them. We were cutting locks, cutting doors. And quite honestly, there was a Harley Davidson, one of them. The rest of them, I don't know if they would have valued $1,000. So I guess, for me, I'm curious, how many do you see that would be over $1,000? Probably very few, is that correct?
Well, that's one of the reasons why we personally have gone into strictly RV storage, because usually RVs are worth more money than this. This was a surprise to me. I opened it up. There was an old junker motorcycle in there that was probably worth maybe $100. There was a jet ski in there that had looked like they'd been running on the land more than they had the water, and that might go for $300 or $400. But it's like you're saying, but the rest of my place has all got good RV storage.
Sure.
Units in there that are worth more than $1,000. So I have very, very little use, you know, of this. But when you do, it's a nuisance for me, and I really have empathy for the people that have the mini storage that do what you're talking about right there.
It is amazing what people spend money on to store, and I think that it's probably a short-term idea, like I'm just going to hold this for a month or two, but it's amazing what's in some of these units. Absolutely. And how people are paying a monthly fee just to keep hold of that when Craigslist would cost them $25. But anyway, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Kinnear.
Just on that note, it's been interesting on TV. They have these storage locker sales, and they've been making quite an effort to point out that the glorious events where they find very valuable things are pretty rare
and staged.
You are talking about Los Angeles television shows.
Yes.
That are probably doing lockers that the owner of the locker could not make payments because he's in jail. He's a thief. So
they didn't address that, as far as I can tell.
That all of us in this storage business absolutely hate the fact that that show came out. I know it's popular.
Yep.
Because each of us, I'm down to probably maybe 5 or 10 calls a month. Oh, do you have any sales coming out? Before that, I was getting 50 and 60 calls a month.
That's because we're in session now.
Okay. I do have two questions. What happens when you have these sales when you don't sell the things that are in the storage area?
I will give you a receipt saying that you bought this storage unit mm-hmm. on this date, and you would have that piece of paper there. Like, for example, the jet ski that I was talking about, they're going to have to go down to the Marine Board to register that. It takes four pages to fill out for that.
Well, what happens if you don't sell it, and do you throw it away? Are you stuck with it? More storage?
Years ago, I'm standing there and I'm opening up a unit, and here's this boat on a factory-built trailer. It's one of these little go-fast low boats with a big engine in the back with the chrome stacks and the jet pump and everything, something that'll do 70 miles an hour on the water. I can't sell it. I had to take the highest bid that I had, $200.
Okay, fine. And the $250 to $1,000 is just kind of to move with the times?
I'm sorry?
To go from $250,000 from $250 to $1,000, is that just to keep up with the times and the rising
economy? I'm looking at today's value of the dollar, and that $1,000 is probably more than worth what the $250 that was originally put on here. And the $1,000 would cover the nuisance sales mm-hmm. that we would have.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So all we have signed up, so I close the public hearing on House Bill 2688 and open up public hearing for House Bill 2909. Representative Williamson and Stephen Shea and John Mullis, please. Yes, if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Jennifer Williamson, House District 36. It's my pleasure to be here today on House Bill 2909, which would change the name of the Center for Research on Occupational and Environmental Toxicology at OHSU to the Oregon Institute of Occupational Health Sciences. OHSU is located in my district, and I am pleased to introduce this legislation. Currently, the research at OHSU is identifying life-saving treatment of disease and conducting innovative work that improves lives. This research also fuels our economy by providing good-paying jobs filled by smart and successful people. So it is a particular win-win that OHSU is implementing a strategic plan to expand its research and outreach to help working Oregonians and their families by focusing on prevention. The current name of the institute, the Center for Research on Occupational and Environmental Toxicology, is too narrow to represent the expanding work they are taking on. And because it is named six different times in statute, changing the name is required by legislation. With me today is the Institute's director, Stephen Shea, to share a little bit more about what they do.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Stephen Shea. I'm the director of CROET, or Center for Research on Occupational and Environmental Toxicology.
Say that real fast.
If you don't mind, it was difficult to say, and I think you said it wrong twice.
For the record.
Toxology instead of toxicology.
Those freshmen, we really have to watch them.
That is why we have to change the name.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I hope this makes the freshman videotape. We've all done it, by the way.
I only said that to underline the problem before us. So in 1995, the legislature established the Center for Research on Occupational and Environmental Toxicology, or CROET, at OHSU. Our mission is to promote health and prevent disease and disability among working Oregonians and their families during the working years and through retirement. As you might expect from this mission, we perform research and educate health and safety professionals, and we address the public and try to reach out to the public on occupational health and safety issues. We actually perform what is called total worker health research aimed at prevention as well as rehabilitation, rather than just solely research on occupational and environmental toxicology. So the current name represents only a little portion of what we actually do. And changing the name to the broader name of Oregon Institute of Occupational Health Sciences will accomplish several things. First, the new name will, of course, more accurately describe what we do. It will help the public more accurately recognize what we do. It will actually help us recruit more top-notch faculty who are working in areas that are not represented by the current name, we're trying to recruit people in the general area of occupational health sciences, and that's a sort of barrier to bring people in with the current name because they're not working in that field. And finally, because of that, if we broaden the name, I think it will help us compete more effectively for other funds, for instance, for health. We appreciate that you have probably more complex and weighty policy matters than changing a name, and thank you for your time to consider this. I should stress that there's no cost at all for associated with this proposal. And if you have no questions, I'd pass it over to John Molis, who is the co-chair of the Management Labor Advisory Committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is John Molis. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Building Trades Council. And as Dr. Shea referenced, one of the volunteer hats that I wear is the management co-chair of the Workers' Comp Management Labor Advisory Committee, or commonly known as MLAC. So I've been very familiar with CROAT for many years. They present to our committee on a regular basis and provide us with updates of their activities. As a representative of working Oregonians, I support their mission in trying to promote worker safety, making for healthier workers, healthier workplaces through prevention. And I have two reasons to support this bill. The first is that I think their name change more accurately would reflect their mission and what they do. And the second reason is, and we all got to share a bit of a laugh about this, their existing name is very hard to say correctly once or quickly three times. I don't care how you look at it. The Oregon Institute of Occupational Health Sciences. It just flows right off your tongue. It's a lot better. So,
what was the other one?
Center for Toxicology and Research something. No, I'm being facetious, but it's just a lot more difficult. And I think who wants to get involved with something that talks about toxicology? That doesn't sound like any fun. So I think the new name is much more accurate. It'll be a good change all in all. So I would respectfully urge support for this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Do you have any questions? Mr. Matthews, I know what you're going to be saying.
No, I'm just curious if you've considered the impact. I mean, CROAT has been an acronym I've been using for years, and in fact, a lot of my documentation with constituent contact has CROAT in it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that it's easy enough for us to change on the way, but there might be others just like our office that have the same correspondence. Just a concern, but... Yeah.
I think that we're going to address that as best we can with a sort of rebranding initiative.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to suggest an amendment, the John Kirkpatrick Center, but anyways.
Any other questions?
Just a comment. I think it'd be nice to get rid of some toxics. So.
And then on a letter, I'm just wondering, how would you pronounce OIOHCS if you want to put in an acronym?
We don't want to use the acronym.
Thank you. That way people know exactly
somebody
what your purpose is,
yes,
which is very good. We appreciate what you guys do. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I close the hearing, public hearing on 2909. And that finishes what we have with public hearings. We do have some work sessions, but we're waiting for the fiscal on 20. Actually, I'm going to open a work session. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2061. We need to carry this over to the next agenda because we don't have a fiscal on it yet. So With that, I...
Did you want to add the dash one amendments, though, or have we added them?
Can we add the dash one amendment on that one or not?
Yes, without the fiscal, do you want to...
Yes, if we could do that.
At least it'd be ready.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2061.
Excellent.
I was just going to explain what the bill was.
Oh, if you could please go ahead and then I'll continue.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill was before you last week and it reduces the amount of time that AMCs have to pay their appraisers. Currently, they pay, they have 60 days to pay. And the bill would reduce it to 30 days. You have a dash one amendment before you that is somewhat of a compromise. It requires the AMCs to pay within 45 days.
Okay, thank so that's the amendment that we're voting on. So Representative Kinnemer moves to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2061. Is there any discussion? Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did it. I know there's some folks from the appraisal industry out there, but it's my understanding from emails that I've seen that the appraisal management company at the national level, their association has agreed to the 45 days for the appraisers.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted. And we will carry this, the entire agenda item, over to the next agenda once we have the fiscal on 2061. And so I close the work session on House Bill 2061. Thank you. The next thing on the agenda was going to be a work session on 2069. And again, we're waiting for a fiscal on that one. So we'll carry that one over to the next agenda. And it's the same sort of thing with House Bill 2403, carry over to the next agenda because we do not have a fiscal on it. But I would like to open the work session on House Bill 2443. And Kate, if you could summarize what the bill is.
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is House Bill 2443. This is the wine growler bill that we talked about recently. There are three amendments. The dash one amendment requires the person filling the wine growler to have a OLCC service permit. The dash three adds an emergency clause, and the dash four amendment basically creates consistency so that where beer growlers are offered, wine growlers are offered as well. So there's consistency. And we have no fiscal, no revenue on any of the amendments.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Kinnemer?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move we adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2443.
Okay, Representative Kinnemer moves to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2443. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? Okay, if not, the dash one amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash three amendments to House Bill 2443.
Okay, Representative Kinnemer moves to adopt the dash three amendments to House Bill 2443. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing no discussion, is there any objection? Okay, if not, the dash three amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash four amendments to House Bill 2443.
Okay, Representative Kinnemer moves to adopt the dash four amendments to House Bill 2443. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the dash four amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2443 be reported out of committee with the due pass as amended.
Okay, Representative Kinnemer moves House Bill 2443 be reported out of committee with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, Brandon, would you please call the roll?
Representative Thatcher.
Excused.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Holvey.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Weidner.
Excused.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kinnemer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Excused.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Is there anyone who would like to carry this on the floor?
Here it
is. Okay, I know that Representative Colby and Representative Thompson were the initial
sponsors
of the bill.
Joint carry it.
So would you like to put Thompson and Holvey down? Okay, so Representative Thompson, Representative Holvey be carrying this on the floor. Any other business before us today? Okay, seeing none, I adjourn the meeting of the House Committee on Business and Labor. Good day.